thank you, Senator Worth, and thank you for having us join this wonderful event and this great coalition. It's been an interesting morning. I think we've talked about some fascinating technologies on both the fuel source side as well as the grid and the infrastructure side. I guess I'd like to take us further down the grid all the way to the home and to the office building, you know, the place where we sit and the place where we live. We do believe the American people get it, but we also know from our research that less than 25% of Americans understand that the single biggest user of energy in our country is residential commercial buildings. 40% of the energy in our country is used in homes and buildings, 74% of the electricity. So if we're really going to take on the issue of the grid, I guess I would echo President Clinton's comments. The first thing we need to do is start working today on the energy efficiency of the places where we work and live. For most of us, unless we're wealthy enough to hire an architect to build us a home, or we're a big enough corporation or government to be involved in the design phase of our building, we inherit that infrastructure that we live in. And this is an important part of the infrastructure of our country. And really, I don't think our policy generally deals with construction as though it's a part of our nation's infrastructure. And in fact, it is. I think there's an opportunity through this coalition and through new policy to establish a public-private partnership between good government regulation that establishes performance standards in construction, that encourage us to get to higher levels of efficiency, that give incentives in existing buildings to get them to higher levels of efficiency. We'll see that with weatherization. We are eager to get in the game of trying to figure out how to get the weatherization money into the marketplace to get our economy to be more energy efficient. We believe with the size of this challenge, that has to be a critical and visible element of any solution, and we believe this coalition is up to that challenge. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, and we appreciate that, Michael. And Owens Corning has certainly been a leader, along with your sort of sister company, I guess, Corning, in terms of the revolution that existed before in fiber optics. Matt Simons, do you want to give us a window on your perspective of how philanthropy and organized philanthropy is helping to engage the public and keep the standard as high as possible?
Thank you, Senator Worth. I don't have anything really prepared to say today because I really was thinking about everything that everybody was saying around the room, but in thinking about the conversation today, I have been struck with a couple of things. I've only been working on this issue, and the issue of climate change and energy is really what we're focused on entirely at this point. For a short time, don't have the perspective of many of the people in this room. And it is interesting because I remember talking to many people, and the first really large thing I got involved with was with the Energy Foundation, and there I see Rose McKinney-Jones and Eric Heitz in the back there, on the issue of Renewable Portfolio Standard, Renewable Energy Standard, and also CAFE Standard, and tried to push that through in 07, and we didn't get the RES through, as people all around this table know. We did get the CAFE through, and that was very exciting. And to me, it was like, well, okay, well, that was good. Now let's keep going. And to see the reaction of everybody in the environmental community, in this energy community, as to how dramatic that was, I didn't feel that. I'm like, okay, well, that's just the first step. We have many things to do, obviously. And I think that to see a group of people around the table and to see the consensus that's around this table that we have to get moving is obviously very exciting. But as Governor Pataki so eloquently said, when the rubber hits the road, or I suppose when the electrons hit the grid, I suppose is a better way of saying it, then it's a different game. And I think that the role of philanthropy is more than anything to just facilitate the process. Where there are many different stakeholders, and they all have to be brought together. The grid is perhaps the best example that we can think of, I think, where there are many disparate interests. And to get it done quickly is going to take a Herculean effort from all sides. And it's because it's not really a question of whether we move to a low-carbon economy. I think it's clear that we're moving there, and it's clear that we're going there. I think there's probably complete consensus around the room that that's going to happen. The question is how quickly. So the role of philanthropy is really to facilitate that process in every respect, because it's not going to be ramming something down the throats of certain people. We know that that's not going to work. We've seen that. We've watched that movie before, and we know it's not going to happen. And we can't take this momentum and let it stall. So philanthropists, foundations, have a huge responsibility. They can't put the steel in the ground. They can't build the windmills. We can't build the new generation of efficient cars. We can help to facilitate the process. We don't have any stakeholders that we have to represent. We can represent the United States. We can represent humanity. We can do the things that need to happen to bring people together, to find common ground, and to move the ball forward. And I think that that's really the role that philanthropy needs to continue to do. And I just, last note, again, there are many, many great work, much great work has been done by philanthropists and certainly by NGOs and working with Carl Pope at Sierra Club and many, many others. But there does need to be more capital to move into the from philanthropy. There need to be more funders. And I think that foundations are starting to understand that, but they have many legacy positions. Some of them are constrained by their mandate. But everything which they do is going to be jeopardized by climate change. All the good work that they do, feeding people, clothing people, educating people, trying to raise up the world from poverty, is all jeopardized by climate change. So it's in everybody's interest that this happens. And I certainly hope that more capital comes in from existing foundations and from new foundations. And hopefully we can, because it's needed. It's clearly needed.
Nat, thank you very much. And that's certainly reflective of earlier comments from President Clinton we're going to hear from in closing in just a minute. Before getting to closing, let me ask John Willinghoff from FERC or Fred Butler from NARUC. Both of them had been part of the discussion earlier this morning. Both of them are in these critical regulatory positions from the federal authority and the state regulatory authorities. If either of them have closing summary comments they might like to add to the discussion. John?
Thank you, Senator Worth. And again, I want to thank Senator Reid and John Podesta for putting this together and having me here with this great group of people and the topics we're addressing here. In summary, I think what we have to remember here is certainly what Congressman Markey and Robert Kennedy said, and that is that the framework of the markets has to be gotten right. And taking up President Clinton's theme of not forgetting about energy efficiency, in framing those markets right, which FERC has the responsibility over the wholesale electric markets, we need to ensure that consumers can understand their part and can be part of those markets, that in fact they can play a part in being an integral part of the grid with demand response, with what I call dispatchable conservation. And so hopefully a good portion of the $11 billion we have in the stimulus package will be used for augmenting and encouraging this dispatchable conservation so consumers, in essence, can participate in the grid. Once they can participate, once they can see how they can control their loads, you control the load in this building, you control the load in a residential building in a way that can help the grid, ultimately, that will have the effect of making consumers know that what we're doing overall with siting transmission and putting renewables in is integral to what they're doing as well on their grid side. And we talked about earlier needing storage. I think we have plenty of storage in this country. The thermal mass in the buildings in this country is more storage than we need. We just need to know how to control it. We have the way to control it from a standpoint of technology. We need the infrastructure. We need the communication standards. And I think there was a discussion about communication standards and FERC's responsibility to do the standards for the smart grid. We're working with NIST on that. It has to be done, as Dr. Chu said, faster. We need to get moving on that faster. If we can do that, though, consumers then can understand how they're part of this grid process, and being part of that grid process, I think we'll all move ahead much faster. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, John. Fred Butler? And I'm going to come back to Boone Pickens, if I might.
Thank you, Senator. And let me once again thank the organizers of this group. It reinforces in my mind that we are living in an extraordinary time that we can sit around this table and have this discussion that we need to have. I've repeatedly said that the times we live in remind me of the opening lines from A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was a time of reason. It was a time of insanity. We all know why it's the worst of times, the economy and what we're dealing with. But it's the best of times because we're focusing on some issues that we have not been able to focus on for a long, long time. And that is a good thing. Now, we isolated three components of this, which was planning, siting, and cost allocation. Let me focus on the planning aspect and talk about the position of the states, which I represent from the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, in addition to being a regulator in my own state of New Jersey. The members of Congress know how difficult it is to get consensus among the 50 states. I have my own little Congress of 230-some-odd utility commissioners, and it's very difficult to get consensus from them. And the consensus has been for the last number of years that we are opposed to federal takeover of the siting responsibility, and that continues to be the position. However, there has been a discussion that has ensued among those states that is leading to consideration of perhaps a shared responsibility, but that the planning process needs to start with the states and the state plans and the state perspectives, and then go into a sort of more regional approach. Then we can talk some more about who has the ultimate siting authority. Because if you have involvement in the planning process, when the line is drawn, and you can say, yes, we realize that that level of transmission needs to be built, that that amount of transmission needs to be built, and it needs to be built here, in general, here, then states can get more involved and can get on board. I also think that it helps explain to the public at large who are going to be impacted by that transmission line. And believe me, I've cited transmission lines and I've cited gas pipelines, and the transmission lines are the ones that get in people's face and the ones where they get upset about, and they come to state capitals and state commissions. They don't necessarily come to Washington. So the states are moving. The states are thinking about this, discussing it. I'm here to tell you that we're willing to work and work to a solution that we can all live with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fred. And you certainly point to two of the major issues that Senator Reid and his legislation are going to have to grapple with on the regulatory jurisdictional issue and the siting issue, overlapping and very complicated, very difficult, but absolutely critical. Boone Pickens, as we have had this discussion, if I were sitting where you were, I would have a certain amount of, from time to time, discomfort as some of the fuels that have been responsible for driving our society have been perhaps a little bit maligned from time to time. Others have been encouraged from time to time. You know, there have to be ways in which we can deal technically with so many of these to bring more natural gas online where that's possible, to engage, as Steve Chu was suggesting, many of the problems that exist in the coal world. Maybe you could close with a view on looking at those fuels and how terribly important it is for us not only to understand how to deal with these fuels, but also how we can do that in a way that makes us more secure as a country. And again, from all of us, thank you for helping to get us all together here and launching this major effort.
Senator, I would like to say that, and I'm going to go back to at the end of my sophomore year in college, but we must have a plan. We've got to have a plan to solve the problem. And I keep harping, I know, no plan in 40 years, but my dad said at the end of my sophomore year, he said, son, a fool with a plan can beat a genius with no plan. And I'm afraid that I have a fool with no plan. And I see us here. Let's don't let this opportunity get away from us. We've got to have a plan. The natural gas, there's no question, it's the only thing that's going to replace diesel. So we have to use it, and it's abundant, it's cheap, and it's ours. That is a key. The light duty goes to the battery, and that's the way it should go. The natural gas will be the bridge to the next generation of transportation fuels. How long does it last? 20 to 30 years. If the solution comes quicker, natural gas is so valuable to our country, it can be used in so many other ways. It doesn't have to be used for transportation. But here, it's going to have to fill that void of no other fuel that we have that'll move a big vehicle. So 40 years, we have been caught in the same trap, cheap oil. But I can tell you that's over with. They've told you, Naomi told you on the 60-minute show, that they have to have $70 to $75 for the oil. Listen to them, because they are telling you the truth. They do have to have that. And you're going to get it. You're going to have it by the end of the year. Now, I'll say that in 2 years, you're going to be back up to 140 is where you're going to go. So we need to move as quickly as can to solve the problem. And this is the time for leadership. It's a time for leadership. And I, you know, around this table, what a great day it's been for me to see the comments that are made, a effort here that has nothing to do with politics. It's clearly a bipartisan issue. Is an energy problem for America is going to be solved. But don't be stopped, and I'll close with this story, don't be stopped by that 10% that are, I don't care what it is, they're opposed. And I want to, we had an old gentleman in my county where I lived, and where my ranch is in Roberts County, Texas. He was 90 years old. He was born in that county, and he lived there for 90 years. Really didn't enjoy leaving the county. It was good enough for him. He liked it. And we had got together at the county seat and at the gymnasium and passed through and shook hands with him. And the person in front of me said, Mr. White, he said, this is remarkable. He said, you were born in this county. You've lived here 90 years. He said, in that 90 years, you saw a lot of changes, didn't you? And he said, yeah, and I was against every damn one of them. That's a 10% that we can't let stop us. Thank you.
Boone, thank you very much. And I know all of us will join together and come to Stillwater to the Pickens Arena and award you the collective Nobel in planning and effective activity when all of this legislation gets passed.
Thank
you'll
you. I'll
be one of the
I'll
key
be ready.
Guys out front.
Okay, thanks.
Albert Gore.
Thank you again, Tim, for your great leadership. And I'm struck by the tone of this meeting and the sense of purpose. There's a real inspiration here, and I'm really happy about it. One time when I was working as a newspaper reporter, my wife Tipper and I got a puppy for our youngest children, and a woman that worked in advertising had a sideline as a dog trainer, and we got her to come over and help us with the training. And she sat us down first, and she said, okay, before we begin, what is this puppy's purpose? I said, well, is it going to be a puppy? And she said, no, is it going to be a hunting dog? Is it going to be a watchdog? Is it going to fetch? And then she said something that really stuck with me. She said, a puppy has to have a purpose. And if that's true, so do we. And I think our generation's purpose is to save the habitability of the earth. And again, that sounds like that sounds like language that's quite unfamiliar. But Fred Butler referred to A Tale of Two Cities. Here's a tale of two planets. Earth and Venus are exactly the same size. They have exactly the same amount of carbon. The difference is, here on Earth, the miracle of life and the unique processes on Earth have pulled the carbon out of the atmosphere and left it buried in the ground. And on Venus, it's still in the atmosphere. So what difference does that make? Well, here the average annual temperature is 59 degrees Fahrenheit, and on Venus it's 855 degrees Fahrenheit, and it rains sulfuric acid. And the whole difference is, virtually the whole difference is, the distribution of the carbon in the planetary system. And it's relevant to our current global civilizational strategy of taking as much carbon out of the ground as quickly as we can, putting it in the atmosphere. So our purpose is to quit doing that and to shift over to renewable sources. The second thing that hit me, Rick Fedrizzi referred to the McKinsey study. Now, there hadn't been too much jargon in this session here today. It's been great. It's been really accessible to me and I think to everybody. It's been a great discussion. But I want to highlight what Rick's referring to there, because I think it's a really important body of knowledge that we sometimes easily overlook. That study he's referring to was done for a Swedish company called Vattenfall, and many people here have seen the graph that resulted. Graphs can be confusing, but this one's been around so much, and here's what it shows. A great deal of the most effective things we can do to save energy, to save money, and to reduce CO2 do not have a price tag. They have an economic benefit. Amory Lovins, who's been right about a lot of things for a long time, is so smart. Whenever he's talking, it's like drinking from several fire hoses at the same time. And he was going on and on one time, and he said, we've got the sign wrong. And I'm thinking, okay, this is Amory. He's talking about cosine, tangent, calculus. And I went back and I said, explain that to me. He said, no. When I said sign, I meant plus sign and minus sign. We're putting a plus sign to say this is going to cost a lot of money. And the truth is, a lot of it has a minus sign. It saves us money. So several have made the point that getting the economic incentives right, and as Bobby said, getting a marketplace that unleashes all this ingenuity and innovation is really the key in a lot of respects. Because presently, sometimes the incentives for the builder of a building, for example, drive the builder to get the lowest first purchase price. But the incentives for the person that's paying the lease or buying and operating that building are to get, are to pay attention to the lowest operating cost. But because those incentives are out of whack, the market does not help us as well as it should and could if we reach out, get that low-hanging fruit, as they call it, and get the economic savings that can come from reducing CO2 right away. Now, finally, the Unified National Smart Grid, whatever it ends up being called, has a gestalt about it. When it's all together, it gives us the ability to put that cost-saving incentive into it and make clearly and plainly visible, easy to understand for all of us, exactly where the savings can be made. Secondly, it gives us the opportunity to link the rooftop, this has been said, the rooftop installations, and eventually shift to a widely distributed energy production system. In the beginning, we're going to have these utility scale and the central station plants because that's, we can't shift everything overnight. But eventually, with a unified national smart grid, it'll be flung out to the periphery, and we'll have this widely distributed energy generation capacity. And finally, it will also help us solve the battery problem, because batteries are not only devices that sit in cars or in machines, they can also be, we can also have a widely distributed battery. And Secretary Chu said earlier, it solves the intermittency problem because someplace the wind's blowing, someplace the sun's shining, and we can move it around. But we can also use it to have stored electricity in cars while people are at work, in cars while people are asleep, in millions of smart devices that are connected with one another on the part of the internet that we as people don't use, that are constantly balancing this, and the consumption goes down and down. Electrifying the auto fleet, using natural gas for the 18-wheelers and the heavy vehicles as a transition, then we can get off of all those imported liquid fuels that come from foreign oil and foreign products and solve the security and economic problem and put people to work in the process. So I really think there have been very few meetings of this kind that I've gone to over the years that had as much consensus and good spirit as this one. And I just think keeping the momentum going and getting this thing really over the top, I'm really optimistic and hopeful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President. You, as ever, have given us an overall framework and the purpose of this puppy, and we're going to drive it and train it and make sure that it stays in the right room and does what it's supposed to do as well. Mr. President, you began with a wonderful view of the world, and maybe you could reflect on what you've heard here this morning, and you know, what message would you like us to take away as well?
Well, I'm going home thinking about the puppy with a purpose and the 90-year-old man who was against every change he ever met. It really is that portrait Al painted of Venus and Earth is pretty graphic, but it's something that ought to be burned in our minds. Let me just make a couple of comments here. First of all, I agree that this has been very, very moving because we've all held together in the ups and downs, and finally we got a consensus to move. The details matter. That's the first thing Al said. It's really true. When Robert Kennedy and Congressman Markey were talking about the Telecommunications Act and what a good job we did to create jobs, I owe a lot of that to my vice president, who was involved in this for a long time. We had lunch once a week for 8 years, and we started talking about all this stuff. And I'm grateful to him for the work he did on that issue. And we both care a lot about this energy thing. But I would like to just make a couple of comments. We all know that no matter what we do, we're going to have national cap-and-trade legislation. We're going to have a standard for electricity generation. Al wants a higher one, and I think we can be a lot higher than we think. And we all know we're going to have a global agreement. Hillary just got back from China when Todd Stern went with her, who's going to be the negotiator for the president. And I just want to just say one thing without kind of getting beyond her report. She said, if you look at, there's a lot of interesting things going on in China, and they get this. They know this is a problem. They just don't know how to get from where we are to a 50% reduction. Now, the rest of us don't get to make this deal with China. We can advocate, but or with India or with anybody else. So I will say again, I think the rest of us should focus on what we can do that is right in front of us that will make a difference. I'll just give you three or four examples and then close. I don't see how we can create the kind of market for entrepreneurial people in their homes and buildings that Robert Kennedy advocated unless we mandate decoupling and stop favoring the financing of big, expensive, centralized power plants over the financing of small, totally clean energy investments. That will put more money into what the U.S. Green Building Council is trying to do. There are only two or three states in the whole country that have the authority to do it, absent state legislation, and only California has done it comprehensively for electricity. I don't know, 11 or 12 have for natural gas. So I think we have to do that. There are on the books now, just waiting to be implemented, increased efficiency standards for about 15 well-known household appliances with very good technology that's well-established. We ought to do that, more jobs and more savings. The third thing I had an idea for, when Lee Scott was talking about this, something we've had a gazillion conversations of this over the years, and Walmart really has done a marvelous job of being more efficient. But they're a big company with smart people who can figure stuff out like this. In the Depression, when we were trying to figure out how to save small farmers, the Agricultural Extension Service was set up. The Energy Department, SBA, everybody, we need a virtual energy extension service that can go into every home and every small business in the United States that gives as much information as the rest of you are willing to share about what you did as it might be applied to smaller units. And finally, let me just say one thing nobody has talked about that I think is important. If you watched the Oscars last night, Slumdog Millionaire won 8 Oscars. And those of us who saw it probably liked it that they won those. I did, anyway. But if you know the opening scene of the movie, these kids are playing stickball on the airport in Mumbai, and the police come up because they're about to get killed and crash some planes besides, and they run them off, and they start chasing them. And before they get back to their slum, they run across the Mumbai landfill. And they might as well be sprinting across the Sahara Desert. And you see people there making a living, scrounging in the landfill. We're trying to help them close that. And one in Lagos, Nigeria. And we've negotiated with Mexico City and other places. Look, this is really hard, but only thing I want to say is Van Jones is trying to make poor people a part of this equation. The poorest congressional district in America is the South Bronx in New York City. The governor used to get grief for bringing garbage to the South Bronx, right? The mayor gets grief for, it's the dumping ground of New York City. We can close all these landfills, recycle the metal and glass, and compress the organic material. And my favorite use is to use it as biomass fuel for generating electricity either into the grid or for cogeneration for some business. You can also compost it for fertilizer. You can use it as a biofuel to drive for biodiesel or ethanol. But my point is, this is economical now. We need to set up a system where we close every big landfill in America. Because we have to, while we're depending on the president and his cabinet and others to figure out how to get us a new post-Kyoto climate change deal, while we hope and pray the Congress won't get pressured out of giving us a really tough cap and trade system, the rest of us need to show that this can work. All we can do, the rest, we're not, if you don't have a vote in Congress and you're not in this government, your job is to prove that this can work. Because I can tell you that you know, the Chinese, the Indians, even I was in Lagos, Nigeria the other night, man, and this guy's come up to me, the mayor and all these people, they're excited about closing their landfills. I mean, the general awareness of this is greater than you think it is. But people still don't believe we can really do it. And so a picture's worth a thousand words, and and we got to get the market right in America. I don't think we're going to do the equivalent of what happened to telecommunications until you stop favoring one form of utility financing over another, and that means you got to get to decoupling around the country. That's what I believe anyway.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And part of that, again, is changing the rules, and that has to be done in a coalition of people who can then help Senator Reid get done what has to be done. And Mr. Majority Leader, this has not only been a meeting that you called, but a meeting that you designed and a meeting that you stayed through for the whole of the session. All three very unusual and a reflection of your very deep commitment to getting this to happen. So.
Everyone, thank you very much for being here. This is inspirational, but I always think about 60 votes. Senator Bingaman has left. We're going to do an energy bill real soon. I hope that we can focus on a renewable portfolio in that legislation. I hope we can focus on beginning the work that needs to be done on the highway to move this electricity where it needs to be done. We can do it. But I the reason I was happy to hear what Boone said, you know, this is not a political meeting. The problems facing America today with our energy problem is not anything that affects Democrats more than Republicans or vice versa. We have a problem. We are not a secure nation importing 70% of our oil. We have to do something to clean up our environment. We must do that. And I would say with Vice President Gore and President Clinton here, they proved during their 8 years you can have a good environment and have a good economy. And that's what this is all about. So I so appreciate everyone's cooperation, their involvement in this. We've got a lot more to do. And as President Clinton said, those of us in government have a tremendous burden, but we can't do it without you. We all have a burden. And for Al Gore to listen to the facts that he's been giving us, I can remember his talking about this when we were both in the House together. He had that crazy chart in his office that was kept going higher and higher and higher. This is something that I so admire and appreciate the work that you've done. This is something that certainly the world has recognized with the giving of you of that Nobel Prize, and you certainly deserved it. You deserve the Emmy. You deserve the Oscar. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here.
Senator Reid, thank you very much, and I will ask John Podesta for closing words for the good of the order. John?
Extremely quickly, I think this has been a great morning. I want to thank Tim for the great job he did moderating the session. We've been treated to a lot of bad news lately. I think this has been a very optimistic session about what can happen if we really do end up empowering and enabling consumers and train and employ workers for this new economy. So I'm very excited coming off of this. I would just say we're going to leave, but you're going to stay in your chairs, I hope, because I think Stan has a little bit of work for you to do on the dial meters. But this we'll have version 2.0 of our paper out for Senator Bingaman, and hopefully as I said, we put wind at the back of the change that we need. So thank you all for being here.